He's actually written so many books. I'll just give you a couple of them. Michael Collins, the IRA, and Wherever Green Is Worn, Story of the Irish Diaspora. His latest book is called The Famine Plot, England's Role in Ireland's Greatest Tragedy. And so one might say that he, like so many others, shouldn't have any problem in coming to the United States for a very extensive launch of his new book. But would you believe it? Not only was his visa to the U.S. was it denied the first time, but just in case that was in error or the message didn't get through to Tim Pat Coogan, it was denied the second time. And indeed, when the ban was removed, when it was lifted, and when those who know and understand the importance and the significance of presenting historical fact, when they had to come up with a reason why his visa should be cancelled or denied on the first two occasions, from Billy to Jack, the finger pointing, the whatever, and but the good news is that we are now linking with our friend and with Ireland's noted historian Tim Pat Coogan. You're very welcome.
Thanks, Adrian. It's always a great pleasure to come on the show and to talk to you, even though you're a bit inclined to create a sweating of the head when I listen to all the... I was wondering, was it me or Whitey Bulger you had in mind?
That's all right. Well, anyway, you'd have to admit, though, that somewhere along the line, you have a great track record in aggravating the establishments and several others who feel that certain parts of our Irish history might better be left to one side, you know, for the time being.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember a bit of advice that Daniel O'Connell, he gave a young admirer, a group of them came to him. They had some project, and they said to him, we want to go ahead with this, but we're afraid the time is not right. And he said, young man, let me tell you something. As an old agitator, the time is never right. The time is always now to speak out in favor of what you believe in, you know? Good advice and very true.
Yeah. You know, through the troubles and through that part of our history that indeed is nothing to be proud of, and I refer, of course, to the troubles in Northern Ireland over the 30-plus years, there was, again, an attempt by many, and believe me, they weren't all of the political leaders or politicians at the time, but I know that you would know, as we all do, that a great number of people in Southern Ireland might have felt that historical facts, new or old, and particularly during that period, should, you know, be again shelved for the time being in the interest of peace and tranquility.
Oh, yeah, well,
more of the same.
More of the same. I mean, the teaching of history, apart from ordinary reportage, everything was judged by giving aid and comfort to the provision of the IRA, and history was made a part of the Cy War. You couldn't, have anything printed that might, in some way, be used by the provost to back up their historical, ideological footing, as it were. And that also rubbed off very much even on the famine. There were some people believe that, or would want you to believe, that the famine wasn't a famine. In fact, it was only a kind of a 19th century precursor of the Scarsdale diet. I was just looking at an article by a contemporary historian the other day on the internet. Eamon Phoenix is his name, and Eamon recalled that, and Eamon would be very middle of the road now, he wouldn't agree with me that it was genocide, but he was recalling that the sort of principal historian of his day, who unfortunately laid down the template for an awful lot of historical writing, because he and a man called Desmond Williams produced the centenary book on the famine. De Valera wanted a book brought out to commemorate the famine in 1945, thereabouts, and these two boyos, who were teachers of history in UCD, were made the editors of it, but partially through drink, but also through natural inclination. Like an awful lot of Irish historians, they've been trained in England, and they believed in the Whig historian Butterfield's interpretation of it. But your man Dudley Edwards, whose daughter is still fairly active in controversy today, Dudley Edwards said that in an era of misery, the famine scarcely deserved to be recognized. It's barely worth noting, you know? So that anything even then was, you know, you were exaggerating something that wasn't as bad as it was supposed to be. The fact that it cut the population of the country by a third in the space of 5 years wasn't regarded as much. People don't realize the devastation the famine caused. You know, Darfur, those famines that you hear about in Africa, you know, they might cost a quarter of a million lives or 300,000 lives, which is awful and appalling. But the population at the back would be, say, 19 million, 20 million. So what it did to Ireland, and it still has resonances, you know, we learned this deeply ingrained thing, learned helplessness, you can't do anything about it, you know. If you said now today in Dublin to me, Tim Pat, how is it with the suicide rates are up by 50%, as I'm afraid they are. Your best and brightest are leaving the country again, shoaling out of the country. There's unprecedented unemployment, and there's no bankers going to jail, not one.
Yeah.
The immediate answer would be, yeah, and they won't either.
Yeah.
You know, you think there's nothing you can do about the mighty, you know, they're in the seat of power, they have lawyers. And there's no revolution, there's just apathy and misery.
Yeah.
And it's, of course, it's a product of two forms of colonialism, Mother England and Mother Church, the authoritarianism of the church. But these things all had a bearing, and people, you wouldn't give in to that sort of thing in the States. I mean, even though Obama wasn't able to do all he set out to do in the first term, he was put back because people realize really over there, and they realize it through the media, and they realize it through people like yourself, that, you know, there's something wrong about Guantanamo, there's something wrong about having wars going on, there's something wrong about rich people getting richer and the poor getting poorer and no jobs, and eventually public discourse does bring a change. Well, it's very, very slow to happen in Ireland.
And that's fact. I think that to add insult to injury, the number of and the enormous cost of so many tribunals.
Oh, people don't have any faith in the law, you know. I was talking to somebody, a very fine journalist, woman journalist, some years ago, when one of the few gestures that they did make, the government today, they tried to bring in a referendum to change the constitution so they could have select committees, the sort of committees you have in the Senate over there, to investigate things and make recommendations about who was at fault into the crisis and who was responsible for it. And two things happened. The most important and tragic one, in a sense, was It's in a view this woman articulated first to me, but I heard it several times since. I know the politicians are too bloody much power as they are. Look at what they did. And they'd name X, Y, and Z, including people who are up before tribunals, and they'd say, no, no, we're not giving them any more power. And that was voted down. And so we had no... People never found out what happened. Now, if you take it that... they were also advised during that referendum by the mighty. Eight former attorney generals signed a letter, a public letter for the papers, saying that the tribunal, that the Dáil, if it did get these powers, they would be obtruding on a man's right to his good name and the independence of the judiciary. And to give you an idea, one of the signatories of that letter was a man called Michael McDowell, who was the Attorney General at the time, and one of the great men to come to Ireland during the peace process and since, as you know, and he deserves to have his name written in letters of gold, is Chuck Feeney.
Yes.
He really did a lot in the peace process, and he gave billions to Irish education. And one of his enterprises was a thing called the Public Inquiry Institute, and he's a very fine journalist, and indeed a former judge, Mr. Justice Flood, who presided over one of the few tribunals that ever brought in a proper verdict, and or at least a meaningful verdict, and a colleague of mine, a fellow I started in journalism, first-class man, Damien Kyvert, and Frank Connolly was the investigative reporter in charge of it. And they were to do investigative reporting of a kind that hadn't been done in Ireland. And he was working on a story. They had produced one report, and only one. It was into planning in Ireland. It was quite good, but it hadn't, you know, set the heather blazing. But the second one, anyway, the next thing was, as he was doing this report, is Michael McDowell, the Attorney General, handed a document from his office over to a journalist, and the Sam Smith in The Independent, and it revealed that Frank Connolly... somebody had applied for a false passport in his name, or that he, anyway, it raised the question that Frank Connolly might have gone to see his brother, who was one of the Columbia Three. And this was said in the Dáil that he had done it. No possibility of Frank taking a lawsuit because it was said in the Dáil under privilege. And then to compound it, they brought Chuck Feeney in, and he was lectured by the Taoiseach, Bertie Ahern, and by this man, McDowell. And anyway, on the television, Bertie Ahern, the then Taoiseach, was saying, here you have an outside agency bringing information into a country. She couldn't have that. No other country tolerate that. Forgetting, of course, we have the BBC, we have Sky, we have CNN, and that of course, when he retired, he goes and he writes for such a scummy paper that the owner... Rupert Murdoch had to close it down, the News of the World. But anyway, all this happened, and Chuck Feeney was kind of put under pressure. And in the welter of controversy, the Public Inquiry Institute collapsed. And what the public never found out was what was the story they were working on. They were working on Bertie Ahern's finances.
Yeah.
And, you know, no more about it. Other two signatories out of the eight to that letter were... one was the chairman of the Allied Irish Bank, the biggest bank that collapsed, billions down the tubes. And another was that great bastion of the independence of the judiciary and the man's right, the individual's right to a good name, Peter Sutherland of Goldman Sachs. Hmm. And the public never sort of, you know, reacted.
I think though,
at least, whatever your problems in America... I don't think that episode would have gone, as they say, unremarked.
No, I think, though, that the tolerance for now a tribunal to look into the useless outcome of the great number of, again, very expensive tribunals would not be on the cards.
No, and they were done very cleverly to... The cops are very good. There's a good fraud squad there. But they need backup. They need forensic accountants. They need lawyers as well, of course. But with the public service embargo, which has been caused by the crash, by the bankers, we're not hiring those people. So the people who caused the crash are going around uninvestigated because they caused the crash.
Right.
You know, what we really want in this country, what I want anyway, on the 9 o'clock news, television news, I want the perps walk and I want the bracelets and the whole bit. At least you feel something might be done. But here we are, the ordinary people, paying the increased taxes, suffering, watching our loved ones risking unemployment or facing unemployment. Or you wouldn't know what they might do. And the people who caused it all walking around, riding off into the sunset with millions. Anyway, that's all. That's all based.
Well, that kind of brings us up to
history. That lack of get up and you know, the same people who are tolerating that in Ireland would be the outstanding lawyers and trade unionists and agitators in your society. You know, free of the shores of Ireland, they're also free of its shackles.
Recently, last end of September into October. Quinnipiac University and its president, John Leahy, opened the first of its kind, a very extensive museum in Hamden, Connecticut, up the road from New York. And it's Ireland's Great Hunger Museum.
Yes, they were on to the man who's organizing the famine. In fact, I got a call from them too, on to Owen Rogers, who's organizing the famine tribunal, to ask would I go down there and give a talk when I go over to the famine tribunal. And of course, I'd be delighted to, the honor to. That's a great development, that.
Yeah, it is, but maybe it's helpful, and I don't know if this is peculiar to the Irish or not. But they, you know, when there is something that carries the guilt and shame and you know, distractions in the interim, like the establishment, you know, of the Free State, and then that followed by, you know, 30 years of horrific violence in Northern Ireland. I think, there are some who feel, well, yeah, that's all right, because, you know, guess what? The famine, that was from the old days, so yeah, maybe we can revisit that, when in fact there is nothing to revisit, because it hasn't been challenged in the first place, and you know, the sieve that was forever there basically must have had received widespread approval based on the fact that you know, a lot of people, the Irish themselves, those who survived the famine, did have many hang-ups about their own survival, and is that a factor that has moved to the fore?
Ah, yes, I think that's a very good analysis. It's like Holocaust guilt. You know, the survivors of the Holocaust feel guilt at surviving it, but it's also like Holocaust deniers. You know, it did happen though, and one of the myths, of course, is it's not enough to say it was just that the British say solidly wanted the famine. They didn't. It was, if you really were explicit about it, and as I hope I have been in telling the story, you'd point out that it was only a coterie, a section of Whigs and a section of the British establishment. A thing that Irish historians shied away from mentioning was the fact that some of the biggest landlords in Ireland were also very powerful members of the Whig cabinet. And what they wanted was to clear the land for cattle, larger holdings, cereals, whatever. But anyway, not to have the tiny potato plots on which 3 million peasants lived. Get them off. You know, the leases, the land was in a dreadful state, shambles, legal shambles. And, of course, some peasants took advantage of it. They got the paid the rent and got their neighbor's land, and the fact that they went to school with their kids and didn't stop them being turned out in a January night, and, you know, granny and the children and everybody.
Conversely, there has been, though.
Especially in the country, in the long countryside, I mean.
Yeah.
You know, with long memories and long nights and long stories. You
but
know,
there had been stories, and
yeah.
And rightly so,
yeah.
That gives credit to, even though there were a minority, not all landlords in Ireland.
Oh, absolutely not. And half of them, I don't know, would it be half, but a lot of them did try and did. I mean, John Mitchell, who is the great, the man who coined the phrase, God sent the blight, but the English sent the famine, he would be the first to point out that pots boiled continuously all through the famine, in the landlord's kitchen, and wives and mothers and children worked wherever they got the money for the vegetables and the meat to make the soup that they gave out. And they weren't all supers trying to get them to change their religion if they turned Protestant. So there was. I mean, you have to face the fact there was awful sectarianism. And I mean, even to this day, if you wanted to have a famine commemoration day, like I used to be on the National Famine Commemoration Committee that the government set up, and I wanted to get a commemoration across the border, you couldn't have it. The sentiment is still so much against it. This was Catholic laziness and God's providence judging them because of their popishness and their Roman carry-on and, generally speaking, their, you know, over-sexuality that bred irresponsibly and you name it. And the famine didn't come to them. But, in fact, it did, and hundreds of thousands of people died up there as it was in the six counties as a result of it. But even to this day, there's a hang-up from our history that that's not, particularly not easy talked about now because of this commemoration period we're having with the covenant being signed where they swore to resist home rule, first of all, in 1912, and then we'd be facing, not this year, but the following year, the commemoration of the Larne gun running when the Unionists ran in guns with the connivance of the army and the police and everybody else to defy home rule. And then 2 years further on, we'd be celebrating commemorating 1916.
Mm-hmm.
So the green celebrations would follow the orange celebrations. And that's just the physical, the military history. But the social history of the famine is getting squeezed out and all that, and it will have to be left to another day. So you're back to what you were saying in your first question, like O'Connor was saying, there's never a good time. Wait, you know?
Yeah. Now, the famine plot, your book, England's role in Ireland's greatest tragedy, brings to the fore for once and for all the piecemeal coverage, as it were, that particularly throughout the United States, you know, was indeed addressed, and for those who did want to point out England's role, were immediately branded, you know, as you know, a Provo sympathizers, the ragamuffins, you know, that crowd. It brought a tremendous sense of suspicion as this was rolled out. Until, of course, until recent years, where, you know, the Irish Hunger Memorial at Battery Park City and. And now, again, Quinnipiac University's Great Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, you have to have a very respectable presentation that indeed only personified what had been said, you know, in many of the organizations here involved, you know, with facing up to, and particularly those involved in the recent struggle in Northern Ireland, there's a respectability that you know, that has come. Nothing as blatant as your new book, again subtitled "England's Role in Ireland's Greatest Tragedy: The Famine."
Yep. It was their role, of course. And I think you cited two excellent examples there. The respectabilization, as it were, of the famine story. I mean, that is the most moving memorial at Battery Park. But do you remember when it went up and the question of putting it on the curriculum, the famine? I mean, it was fought tooth and nail. People were saying you were giving aid and comfort to the provost and anti-British propaganda, nothing at all like the Holocaust. You know, it's always different. It's always, to quote Al Gore, the inconvenient truth. But it was a truth. Not all the English people, I mean, a lot of them subscribed very generously to what happened for relief. But Whig policy, the Whig or the Liberal Party, as they're called, once they succeeded, the Conservatives, Sir Robert Peel's party, Robert Peel had, he bought in the corn laws, and he changed the corn laws to allow foreign corn to be brought into England against the Squirearchy's wishes. Of course, they hated him for that because they were making a fortune out of selling dear flour, dear wheat to the working classes, the new Victorian working industrial cities that were springing up. And here they had a, no question about it, there was a famine. And, for example, he, sub rosa, because of these laws, without adverting to it, he got the Baring brothers to buy corn and ship it into Ireland, anonymously, as it were. And then he had it deployed from food depots and given out to the people to keep down, or put on the market, rather, to keep down the prices at times so the people could buy it. Whereas the moment they came in, Trevelyan, who was the secretary, the relevant civil servant, the head of the British Civil Service and the Treasury, in effect, he actually turned those ships round. He told Baring, stop, it's over, you know? And we don't need it anymore. And even though Baring and Rothschild, a great Jewish philanthropist and others, they founded this huge and very effective aid organization afterwards, they knew it wasn't, famine wasn't over. The official policy of making, of how the famine would be addressed, changed once the Whigs came in, and Trevelyan wrote that he was very pleased with the attitude of the new masters. He got complete control of the mind of his boss, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Sir Charles Wood. And they finally fetched up after 5 years. I mean, the famine didn't just happen 1 year. In fact, there was famine in Ireland after 1951, but it went on from 1845 to 1851, and people were dying in the most horrendous conditions. The dead carts were rolling out from the workhouses and picking up the bodies from the ditches, and the food carts were rolling to the ports, shipping food out all through it. Some cities in England got 80% of their meat from Ireland during this period. Mm-hmm. And what they were really doing was using the relief operations in a very skimpy and parsimonious way, giving people a few cents a day for roadworks. And you couldn't work the roads because it was 4 and 5 foot of snow and ice on them. And outdoor relief or workhouses and so on, that kind of handout mentality. And at the most low ebb, you know, because they didn't want to make poverty an acceptable way of life, as they put it. And they were using those methods to cloak the fact that they were letting people die so they get the land cleared off through emigration, through fever, through starvation. And by the end, you know, they were also had a huge press campaign, the paper at the time. Mm-hmm. This is a world now before television, radio, or social media. And the Times was the paper in the world, the most influential paper. And they influenced it completely. They controlled its policy. In fact, they wrote some of the editorials. And in return for news and all sorts of things, the editor, Delan was his name, he would produce editorials like one that said they welcomed the famine was one. Another one said that they looked forward to the day when an Irishman, a Celt on the banks of the Shannon would be as rare as a Huron on the banks of the Hudson. And look forward to the day when the Irish would learn manners and would be, you know, living like real people, and would eat meat and not potatoes, and wouldn't be savage and barbaric. And even, you know, when humane landlord Lord Monteagle wrote to Trevelyan, and funny, Monteagle was a member of the cabinet, a minister. And some people would say it's not fair to blame Trevelyan because he's only a civil servant. But he was so powerful that the cabinet minister had to write to him, not vice versa, imploring him to do something for the peasantry. And he was writing back things like, look, our problem isn't the, it's not food, it's the character of the Irish, you know, they're just a backward, awful race, you know, and pointing out, and on what he's supposed to be talking about, relief, he's pointing about the advances they're making. They're getting rid of the middlemen. They're getting rid of the leasing system. This is an advance. So it was really, he was revealing his hand that the real course of action favored was to get the people off the land, not to feed them and keep them there.
Right.
So that was, well, that was the government's doing and the coterie of them. And Trevelyan himself, he's quite an extraordinary man. I found a letter. He didn't get on with Peel before Peel left, in fact. For about 3 years, they were at odds over Ireland because Trevelyan had come to Ireland and he had written an account of what he found there in the Morning Chronicle. This was actually a briefing that he had given to Peel privately. So Peel was disgusted with him that he would go out and blaze this stuff all over the papers, what was meant to be said in privacy in the Prime Minister's office. But the document could have been written by Goebbels, the master of Nazi propaganda. He clearly detested Celts and the Irish and the priests and all that sort of thing. And when he got in charge of Irish Relief, he had a chance to do something about it, and by God, he took it.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, by the way, you're talking about it's not merely the ending of the war and all those things. It's a bit like the butterfly hatching out in a branch. From nowhere, another butterfly will hop, suddenly flutter down beside them. Now, you know, where did he come from? What signal went out? What pheromones? But all over the world today, the Irish anthem, the song you hear singing, is The Fields of Athenry by Pete St. John.
Pete St. John.
About the young man who stole Trevelyan's corn, and now a prison ship lies waiting in the bay. And that's the great Irish anthem. It played at international football matches, both soccer and rugby, and not merely played in Ireland, but in Glasgow with the Celtic football team,
that
in
song
Liverpool with the famous Liverpool soccer team. They call it the Fields of Anfield, because that's where they play.
Yeah.
So there is some sort of nerve struck in the Irish worldwide at the moment about the famine, and people are coming out in the closet, as it were, about it.
Right.
And it's a long way from the days when Dudley Edwards said it was only a small thing in the middle of all the misery.
Right.
And incidentally, the really shameful thing about that first history produced by the National University, it consisted of 7 essays. They were good scholarly essays, but of course they wouldn't attribute blame. There was no question of culpability being addressed. And it took them 13 years to produce that. The famine centenary was 1845, and the book didn't come out in the mid-50s. That's the sort of, those are the taboos and shibboleths. There was part academic, part political, part religious, but somehow the famine today is an idea whose hour has struck. And as you say, there's a famine museum being opened up in Canopia.
Now, also we would like to point out that Pete St. John's song, which spread to all parts of North America in particular, was a kind of respectable introduction in a very clear manner, which gave a respectability, as it were, for those who, A, knew little or nothing about the famine and learned a few verses of that particular song a lot. It was, a mini version of an historical fact and an historical period. the words, again, in the study of the Irish famine, took so long, and indeed we might even double back and give some tremendous credit to former Governor George Pataki of New York, who got this the Irish famine into the state curriculum, so that again, I don't want to beat this into the ground, but it would appear that now, you know, enough time has gone by, and indeed, what many would feel is that we didn't need Tim Pat Coogan to be raking in the coals again, because the famine was complicated. The famine, you know, was something that was not created by England and the British. And here is typically Tim Pat Coogan laying it all out for us, and how are we going to get over the sensitivities and a period that is affecting, you know, Ireland today. And again, we're going round in the same circle in terms of sensitivity and when is the right time.
Never the right time. I just want to tell you, by the way, I second the motion about Governor Pataki. No doubt, that was a great work he did, because there was very heavy pressure on him at that time. The British ambassador and everybody else was involved. I think yourself and Neil O'Dowd and the Irish Voice and all the others were to the fore in saying it should be acknowledged. And I think Battery Park and the curriculum, they're really first-class memorials. That's how it should be done. But I just want to tell you, the last call I had before you was Pete St. John. And we're going out to lunch next week. We're going to watch the Irish Welsh match afterwards here in my house. We're going to lunch first, and it won't be potatoes on the menu, I can assure you. We'll toast all that went before. And I have a great admiration for him. There was a thing that used to be said at the time of the original Anglo-Irish War that, of course, we hadn't a hope of fighting the British, but one man with the song's measure could trample an empire down. Well, he's helped to trample an empire of myth and prejudice and hatred and all sorts of bigotry down. And I think in doing so, while it is true that it was the government of England and they did believe that the Irish land thing could only be solved if 2 million people were cut off the land, and not by sort of a benign system of emigration, which would have been the way to do it, but they let it happen through awful death, through cholera and typhus and starvation. But that was the doing of a certain government sect, and the government was pretty well in the grip of a number of ministers. Yeah. Palmerston, the famous, architect of gunboat diplomacy, who forced the opium wars, for example, on the Chinese, made them take opium, lost their people when they didn't want to, and acquired Hong Kong in the process. And it was Ireland's bad luck that he and a few others owned hundreds of thousands of acres in Ireland. And they espoused this policy, and the Prime Minister, Russell, was so weak. He was a little man. He was the son of a duke. And he was so small when he married a widow. And he was described... He was described as being the widow's mite, and he wasn't able to control the cabinet. If he did want to control them, we don't know. But he wasn't hostile to Ireland personally, because he actually finished off the great poet, Tom Moore, the lyric poet, and he died. It was Russell who actually finished off his autobiography. That was another great Irish landlord. Lansdowne gave Moore, succor, gave him a house in his estate, Bowood, in Wiltshire. But when it came to their estates in Ireland, it was a different matter. Business is business.
Right.
And the famine was the result. They were good men, but they did dastardly things.
You know, the famine plot by our guest, Tim Pat Coogan, has been reviewed. There's one in particular that I think encapsulates the significance of this book, and it is by... Jean Kennedy Smith, the former U.S. ambassador to Ireland, and she says, Tim Pat Coogan knows full well that we cannot go forward until we understand where we came from. Makes a spectacular argument for the future by dealing with the deepest wound from Ireland's past, the famine. Coogan has the wisdom of a craftsman, the urgency of a journalist, the depth of an historian, and the rhythms of a poet. He's one of the great social commentators of our time. There is, and I think, you know, there's a theory that, you know, our past definitely has, you know, a place in history. And it is... it has been covered, it has been hinted at, and indeed on this side of the Atlantic, when we take the courage and the tenacity of, you know, of those who have not put a tooth in it, as it were. Your book is rattling the bushes big time. And again, the fact that, and I don't want to dwell too much in this other than to say, that the influences which somehow got through, to the U.S. Embassy and you know, to under the, direction and under the control of now former U.S. Ambassador to Ireland, Dan Rooney, there had to be some underlying power and group that still exists, and one can only imagine the closed-door sessions that would say, geez, don't let this guy out. Don't turn him loose in America, because you know, we have a lot of other problems. The economy, the Ireland itself. I'm sure that there was a lot of controversy, and indeed to finagle that type of response. To getting you as an historian to come and tell the story.
Well, of course, you'd have to speculate like that, this extraordinary thing happening, because, I mean, I've been back and forth to the States so often. I remember once I was at a lunch given in my honor in the U.S. Supreme Court, been to the White House, etc. So I think it was fairly well established I wasn't going to climb Mount Rushmore and blow the you-know-whats off Abraham Lincoln's head to mark the film. But I just had to say a word about Ambassador Rooney. This thing happened at the very end of his tenure.
Understood.
He was a very distinguished Irish-American. He was personally kind to me when he was there. I don't think it had to do with it. I think it was this security thing. He was old. He wasn't in good health. He's had, I think, tragedy in his family since, and I would exempt him. But there was a regime there in the immigration thing, and they've been doing pretty blackguardly things to other Irish immigrants. Fortunately, I think, to the Irish Americans led by Neil O'Dowd and others, and your good self, once the thing burst, Senator Schuman wrote to them immediately, and you know, the Irish Americans were in uproar. But it was applying to a lot of people. It shouldn't have happened at all. I was phoned by an anonymous person, said he couldn't give me his name for security reasons. I was turned down for twice on Homeland Security reasons, believe it or not. My application was apparently scrutinized by 29 different government agencies. But I was given something I didn't ask for. I'm given, I now have a 10-year multiple application visa. Albeit it has a kind of scarlet letter thing on it saying that this visa was granted after inspection by such and such an agency. But I could be going and going, coming and going to the States every day of the week if I wish now.
Mm.
And my normal attitude to the States is restored.
Let's acknowledge that it was definitely a plot. This was...
Somewhere along the line, whatever agency, whatever grouping, and there are various suggestions who they might be, somebody intervened.
Yeah.
And the Norman Holiday visa, sure, I think I was told, wasn't I over in the States the year before it happened with your good self?
I know.
Do you remember I was chatting with you in your office,
and
we did an interview, that's right, and that was okay. And in fact, I thought that maybe I'd made a mistake, that that visa would have covered me, and I wrote and asked Senator or Ambassador Rooney, is there a mistake here?
Yeah.
But anyway, it got into embassy staff hands and was sent off to the wrong department, and far from just renewing the visa, I got turned down twice. It was on the third application that I got in. The tour, the book tour was cancelled. But anyway, there's terrific interest in my going over there now. Great friendship. And like the university you mentioned and inquired, and Owen...
Oh, I know,
Owen Rogers
Quinnipiac,
and his merry men who are running this famine tribunal want me over. And very good people that I've met over the years are connected with that. And Bobby Balla, you know, the artist.
Yes.
Brian Friel, the playwright, patron of it. I'm a patron of it myself. And, you know, there are people of unimpeccable, you know, probity and interest in Irish history and leaders of the Irish community associated with it. So I think it's time to have it out in the open, and we'd all put our points of view forward in the best American tradition, and let the historical chips fall where they may.
Absolutely,
but
and I think
we have to have a decent respect for the unfortunate people. There's two things, I think. Now, I'd finish on this note, if I may. One, you have to have a decent respect for the unfortunate people who lost their lives. Like, say, the Willetts family.
Right.
They left from Limerick. One child had to be left behind on the docks to die by himself because he had famine fever. Three more died on the ship coming over to Ireland. And then the husband died, and Mary Willis ended up down in Canada, where a decent Protestant clergyman took her in and gave her employment and noted her story. Well, her story is worth telling, and it's her memory is worthy of respect, and many another person who died unknown. And the second thing, the second lesson to be learned, and it's extraordinarily relevant, all this happened because we didn't have a government of our own. We couldn't close the ports. We couldn't keep the food in, stop grain distillation. We couldn't import grain. We hadn't, you know, we hadn't the money. We hadn't a government. And here, with the profligacy of the bankers, the venial politicians, the negligent civil service, who let all this happen in the Department of Finance, bank, central banks, regulators, the rest of them, culpably negligent, we don't have a government. We've lost. We have a government, and we go to the motions, but we've lost our sovereignty. We only get the money to pay the civil servants, to pay the cops, to keep the country going, doled out in intervals from Brussels. Kathleen O'Hoolahan, as we prepare to celebrate 1916, she's standing in a dole queue in Brussels. We may exit the dole queue this year, we may not. But as you and I talk, Ireland has lost our sovereignty. Now, people should read about the famine and realize what can happen to a country when you lose your sovereignty.
The book, friends, the title, The Famine Plot, England's Role in Ireland's Greatest Tragedy. The publisher, Palgrave Macmillan, and the website, www.palgrave.com. We look forward to your coming, and indeed, Tim Pacugan, again, you tell it like it is, and that's good. You don't you don't push it around our history, whether that relates to the famine, or indeed you bring us right up to date today, again making many people uncomfortable. But the truth will out, and we're delighted and indeed proud of knowing you as a friend. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Adrian. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks. Palgrave Macmillan, the publisher, again, www.palgrave.com. palgrave.com. An excellent book, and a very timely release, one which whose launch delayed, but not for much longer. We'll see Tim Pak Hogan here. Indeed, let me give you another website, www.timpatcoogan, that's COOGAN.com, www.timpatcoogan.com. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. Let's take a message from Brian Stack, CIE Tours, indeed celebrating their 80th year of excellence in the touring of Ireland and beyond.
2013 is going to be a very exciting year in Ireland. Hello, this is Brian Stack, president of CIE Tours International, here to tell you that 2013 has been named the year of the Galaxy.